the lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspect of our life.
Welcome back to your audience. You are listening to Lantern from IRB English Radio, and we are talking about cheating and deceiving, which is completely rejected in Islam. Okay, the Islamic religion wants a Muslim to deal with people in a straight manner, not to deceive or cheat them. Indeed, neither the cheater nor the deceiver are believers. Among the examples of deceiving is the way some traders behave in order to cheat each other, such as one who goes to another trader and tells him, "Surely this product is not good, so do not buy it." He says this so that no one competes with him in buying that product, and if others listen to him, he can buy it in order to obtain maximum profits for himself. Verily, this act of cunning and the like are forbidden, as it is a form of deceiving which a Muslim with true belief should never do. Indeed, a Muslim does not cheat another one in any act which causes harm to them. Okay, now, dear listeners, it seems that our time for this episode of Lantern has come to its end. I really wish that you have enjoyed this episode, and I beg Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to help us all in reaching high levels of humanity and religion. Until another episode, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allow this world to deceive you into believing that you are just here to enjoy, to become popular and famous through anything and everything. Some people become famous through sin, and some people, they are famous in the heavens and they are not even known on earth. Because the angels write down their good deeds that they do in secret between them and Allah. Subhana Rabbi al-A'la. May Allah grant us ease of preparation for the day we are going to meet with Him. And one hadith that I love to read and repeat and mention and talk about: Man ahabba liqa'a Allah, ahabba Allahu liqa'ahu. Allahu Akbar. Whoever loves the meeting with Allah, Allah loves the meeting with that person too. You want to meet Allah? Guess what? Allah wants to meet you. And how do I prepare for that day? I try my best. I worship Allah alone. I follow the sunnah of Rasulullah, and I am protective over it. To be protective over the right things is something that will earn you Jannatul Firdaus. What am I protective over? I am protective over my worship of Allah. I don't care what the world says. I worship Allah and Allah alone. And I will not participate in something that is displeasing to Allah. Secondly, I will make sure that whatever I do was taught by Rasulullah. What was the point of sending a messenger if the message he came with was not important or irrelevant, or it was added onto or subtracted from? La hawla wa la quwwata illa billah.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
The entire population of Gaza is enduring destruction unparalleled in recent history. The words of UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. Hello and thanks for tuning in. This is Gaza Under Attack. We'll get to our guests in a moment, but before that, a quick look at some of the latest developments. The UN Security Council holds its quarterly open debate with the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war on Gaza top of the agenda. Israeli occupation forces continue tank and drone strikes on the city of Khan Yunis, with at least 210 people killed over the past 24 hours. More than 200 occupation soldiers dead and 4,000-plus wounded in the Gaza Strip since apartheid Israel started its ground invasion of the territory. Another U.S.-UK strike on Yemen. The country's Ansarullah fighters say they're targeting Israeli-linked vessels because of Tel Aviv's genocidal war on Gaza. In Iraq, resistance groups vow to continue their operations against military bases where U.S. military forces and trainers are stationed in retaliation for Washington's unqualified support for the relentless Israeli war on Gaza after the U.S. military carried out an airstrike against sites used by the Iraqi anti-terror forces. In less than 4 months, the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war on Gaza has killed at least 25,700 Palestinians and wounded at least 63,000 others, most of them women and children. Let's discuss these rapid developments with my guests, Professor Jonathan Rosenheth, Emeritus Professor at the London School of Economics and Chair of the British Committee for the Universities of Palestine, and Katie Durvin, a photographer and activist who joins us via Skype from Glossop, Derbyshire. Thank you both for being here. I'll start with you, Professor, if that's okay. The intense shelling in central Gaza in Khan Yunis, as we just heard, has rendered the idea of any safe space in the entire territory redundant by now. I just want to hear your assessment of where things are or where they're headed, you think.
Well, there are things that are happening, and then there's the way they're portrayed by spokespeople for Israel, and which are then faithfully relayed by media, which is extraordinarily biased in its reporting. We all know by now that Israelis are murdered and Palestinians are only killed. There's no moral agency in what not a negative moral agency mm-hmm. in anything that an Israeli soldier could do because they are obviously in the right.
Mm-hmm. That's certainly the case, of course, as far as corporate media yeah. is concerned. Let me go to Katie now. Israel suffered the biggest loss of occupation soldiers, 24 of them, 21 in a single incident. Might this change how Israelis view the Gazan bombardment?
You'd hope so. I think we're going to see what we're seeing with Israeli soldiers is we're seeing children being brainwashed and sent to kill defenceless civilians and children. And I think we're going to see the aftermath of this for Israeli soldiers and Israeli young people. I think we're going to see a big mental health crisis. We're probably going to see a big rise in the suicide rate as well. But I would hope that this might change their minds, but I don't know if it will.
All right. Professor, I want to bring you a quote by the UK's chief rabbi, Ephraim Mervis. I'm sure you have your own quotes as well. But he said recently that the use of the term genocide, this, of course, in relation to the South African genocide case against the Israeli regime with the International Court of Justice, he says that the term genocide is moral inversion designed to tear open the still gaping wound of the Holocaust. What is your view of that comment?
Every Jewish person in Britain, and probably more widely than that, has lost swathes of relatives in the Holocaust. It's inevitable. We are almost all of us immigrants, or children or grandchildren of immigrants in the last 50 to 100 years, and not all of them came over, and the majority were killed. So we take the Holocaust very seriously. But it is played like a playing card by supporters of Israel who says, because this happened to us, anything that we do is merely defense against it ever happening to us again. Whereas our concern is that genocide should not happen to anybody, anywhere again, least of all by people claiming to be the victims of not the only genocide, but a major genocide in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm. You talked about the way corporate media has treated what's happening in that part of the world. But I want to talk about how the politicians here also have responded to it. We saw the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, in the early days of this genocide in progress, go to Tel Aviv, stand next to Netanyahu and say he hoped that he would win. We heard comments from the leader of the Labour Party, rather, who said that Israel reserved the right to cut off supplies to the Palestinians. But recently, Keir Starmer has said that Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, was wrong to reject moves to establish a Palestinian state. The same man that made that comment now is saying this. What do you think that Keir Starmer's motivation is?
Ambition.
To become Prime Minister, you mean?
He has told so many lies since it, but in order to get elected by the party membership. I am a member. I didn't vote for him, but he said that his aim was to unify the party, and he was taking on all of, or most of, Jeremy Corbyn's mantle, instead of which he made 10 specific promises, all of which he has broken. Now, if he is changing his story on the Palestine question, it is because he sees some advantage. His main aim is to be in the center and be the conservative party, the alternative conservative party. Mm-hmm. And he will maneuver by fractions to try and stay close to the central position, but distinguish himself or to accommodate himself to changes in public mood, because the public in Britain is so strongly against what Israel is doing, and even Keir Starmer can't ignore that.
Not anymore. Let's bring in the United Nations. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has addressed the Security Council during a high-level meeting where the worsening situation in Gaza topped the agenda. Here's what he had to say.
No effective humanitarian aid operation can function under the conditions that have been forced on Palestinians in Gaza and those doing everything possible to help them. The quantity of aid is highly insufficient in light of needs. It is fantasy to think that 2.2 million people can survive on aid alone. Basic commodities from the private sector must enter in meaningful quantities, as they did for many years before the current fighting. This is essential to address rising needs and avert both a complete breakdown and ever-mounting death toll.
The UN chief there speaking, but are his words having any impact, Katie, considering the death toll and the members of the Security Council using their veto or abstention powers to stop a ceasefire being imposed?
It doesn't seem so at the moment. But I think anybody who can say that there isn't a genocide unfolding in Gaza at the moment is not quite in touch with the reality or the humanity. So I would hope that a ceasefire will come into place, but it just doesn't seem like Israel is willing to listen to anybody.
Let me ask Professor Rosenhat, too. There is a sense, Professor, in diplomatic terms at least, that even some of Israel's allies are hoping for a change in tone. As you say, even the leader of the Labour Party here cannot really continue with the same position because of the sheer number of people who have been killed and injured and the destruction in the Gaza Strip. Surely Tel Aviv's actions are no longer defensible.
Well, I don't think they have been defensible from the beginning.
But from the standpoint of their handful of Western backers.
Yes, I think what it's revealed is that the ability of the United States in particular to pull the plug on Israel, which we all sort of assumed, is oversimple. It does seem as if even the U.S. is constrained by or cannot take the actions which would stop Israel from behaving this way for various reasons, which I suspect are the strength of the Israel lobby. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you haven't been able to get elected to Congress basically for decades unless you tread the Israel line, because that money will be thrown at getting alternative candidates elected out in the primaries.
Or attempts that are made by the Israel lobby groups, such as the biggest one is the AIPAC, to prevent progressive candidates, pro-Palestine candidates, from being elected to
the U.S.
Congress.
Yes, indeed. And I think that the it is surprising. It's quite clear that Biden is embarrassed by what's going on. And it's surprising that he holds back from playing the cards, which I think he has, to stop Israel. He's unwilling or unable to do that. And I think,
which is it, unwilling or unable?
That we won't know till history is written.
History is being written as we speak, isn't it? Katie, let me bring you back into the conversation. Can you talk about perhaps the importance of activism to change the needle on the Israel-Palestine question?
I think we're seeing big changes. I think we've never had marches as big as this in the UK for Palestinian rights, and the amount of people that are learning about it, and even learning a little bit more about Islam and different cultures, and the people that are becoming united. I think the biggest weapon that we have in all of this, a peaceful weapon, is unity and coming together, different communities, different religions, people with no religion. That's the biggest thing that we can do. And obviously we can write to our MPs, we can sign petitions, we can go on marches, but really us coming together and being united, that's where we're going to see a big change in this. And that's what we need to do all across the globe.
And since you're a photographer, talk about the impact. I mean, they say a picture speaks a thousand words. The impact of imagery and the pictures and the images that have been taken and sent by journalists or photographers who are based in the Gaza Strip, and of course people such as yourself who are doing photography of pro-Palestine activism here in London and your peers around the world?
I think a lot of the stuff that we've been seeing coming straight out of Gaza has been absolutely devastating to watch. And this is stuff that can't be, you know, it can't be faked like a lot of the Israeli media is trying to make out that it is. It's completely harrowing. And I think anybody who can look at it and not feel that they need to do something to stop this happening to these innocent Palestinian people, I mean, I don't know.
And Professor Rosenhead, as the Palestinian foreign minister recently said, first of all, much of the world is now calling for an end to the bloodshed. If you look at the map, you can tell, you know, what countries are still backing Israel and cheering it on to continue what it's doing there. But much of the world, the majority of the world, is asking for an end to the bloodshed. As the Palestinian FM said, this is a competition, if you will, between the will of the international community and the whims of an Israeli prime minister who refuses all the calls for a ceasefire. What is your view of that?
I think that's a mischaracterization. I don't think that first of all, the international community is a term to describe those people who accept the leadership of the United States. It's not an international community. It's not the world as a whole. Many people are excluded from that or are too powerless to fight against it. As to there being whims of the Israeli prime minister, no, not at all. He has some personal reasons about this, which is the longer he stays fighting, the longer he's prime minister, and so the longer it is before he goes to prison for his corruption.
Yeah.
But the policy of Israel has fundamentally been unaltered over 50, 70 years, which is to get as much land as possible with as few Palestinians as possible.
Are you telling me that this is not to do with one man, one party in power?
Absolutely not. This is what
state policy.
Zionism set out to do from 1890 onwards. It was a colonization process. That's what the leaders at the time said. We want to establish a colony in Palestine. And a pity about the people who are already there.
All right. Then just a quick reminder, this is Gaza Under Attack with me, Saeed Pourreza, where we take a deep dive into the ongoing U.S.-Israeli carnage in the Gaza Strip. Well, a free Palestine is closer than most people think, according to Sarah Russell, a photographer also and an activist who spoke at the 15th Genocide Memorial Day here in London. She says the activism that's going on will ensure the end of violence in Palestine. Have a listen.
Ultimately, I think we will see a free Palestine. And the reason why I say that is that there's going to always be, and never will we stop, this efforts, all efforts to speak the truth and to support, to educate, to continue the process towards an end to this tyranny, the end of this brutal occupation. So it's, you know, inevitable that I always say this, that truth is on the side of the oppressed, and that's something that there are certain powers that we don't see ourselves, that they're actually, I think things, I'm feeling quite positive, though obviously on externally things are very, very heartbreaking, what we're seeing before our eyes and the sacrifices, and the Palestinian actually have no nowhere to go but to embrace their fate, which ultimately this can't be sustainable, the warring, the sort of this genocide that we're seeing, the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. It has to end.
Sarah also said Israel has no legitimate case, and this is why it is self-destructing.
I think it's self-destructive. That whole entity is very self-destructive, because if you have no real legitimate cause and it's only through destruction, that's just not sustainable. It is self-destructible. So that's why I say I just have very, I think we all know deep down, and maybe we need more courage these days to speak the truth, because it's already crumbling. Otherwise, they wouldn't have this need to keep warring. And that's it's a kind of a tactic, or it is the tactic, to divert away from their for their agenda.
With global eyes focused on the ongoing genocide in Gaza, the deteriorating situation of Palestinians living in other parts of the occupied territory may have fallen under the radar. Musicians and activists Nathan Buran and Julia Katerina highlighted the plight of Palestinians in Jerusalem and Jenin, respectively, at a seminar held in Avrar House here in London earlier this week.
As a young woman who was born and raised in Jerusalem, my hometown and the epicenter of the Arab-Israeli conflict, I have witnessed and experienced a plethora of injustice, violations of freedom and human dignity. These experiences strengthened my desire to be a lawyer. Living in Jerusalem is like living through complex legal statuses and overlapping exclusionary and inclusionary circles. So, for example, you can be subjected to Israeli civil and military laws, Jordanian and Palestinian laws, as well as to international laws. You can hold an Israeli ID card and Israeli travel documents, passport, Israeli travel document passport, and hold a Jordanian passport, all while being stateless. Family members in the West Bank, whom we love dearly, are restricted from participating in the most important moments of our lives, such as birth, birthdays party, wedding, funerals, graduations, or even visiting a family member or experiencing illnesses. These are all subject to approval of the Israeli government and often rejected. Normal family moments, which is right of the majority of the people experience, is not possible for Palestinians.
what's happening in the West Bank is mainly overlooked because of what's happening, because what's happening in Gaza is so extreme. And even even before that, though, they managed to bomb Jenin camp over a prolonged period without anyone really taking very much notice or interest in it. Because the world has become so hardened as the situation has been going on as is for 75 years.
All right, let's continue the conversation with Jonathan Rosenhead and Katie Durbin. Thanks for your patience, both of you. Professor Rosenhead, what is the significance of Jewish voices such as yourself speaking out? I mean, you have been suspended from the Labour Party for exactly doing so, but yeah. That hasn't stopped you.
I'm not quite clear why I was suspended rather than actually expelled, because, of course, I'm Jewish, I'm not anti-Semitic, but they have a peculiar definition of anti-Semitism, which is that if you deny that speaking about Israel in a critical way is anti-Semitic, then that means you are yourself either an anti-Semite or conniving at anti-Semitism.
They call you a self-hating Jew, I guess?
That's right. Yeah. So I have not been expelled, but at our latest count, just around 70 Jewish members of the Labour Party have been disciplined, anything from a reprimand, told to go through training, or positively expelled. And that's striking. The proportion of Jewish members who have been disciplined for anti-Semitism is an order of magnitude greater than of non-Jewish members. Mm-hmm. It's extraordinary. But in terms of there is a significant Jewish opposition to what Israel is doing. There is no single Jewish community. There are Jewish communities. There are people with different views. And
exactly.
For example, there have been massive marches here in London, up to 500,000 or possibly even towards 1 million people on regularly on Saturdays. And we have got a Jewish bloc on that march. It started about 20 years ago on Palestine demonstrations. Then there was a handful of people, maybe 10, maybe 50.
Yeah.
It's risen. The last one, we reckon, there was somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 people marching together with banners of all kinds, different organizations, and applauded by other marches, including Muslim marches.
Exactly.
It's a great demonstration of solidarity between people who care about injustice.
Solidarity, that's for sure. Very quickly, last question to Katie. The targeting of and destruction of educational, medical, religious institutions in the name of taking out Palestinian resistance, it is a deliberate ploy by the IOF, the Israeli Occupation Force, surely, is it not?
Yeah, ethnic cleansing and to just erase all Palestinian history and heritage off the map. But it's too late. The game's up. Everybody knows. Everybody's Palestinian now. We're all, you know, thousands in our millions. We're all Palestinians all around the world. So they'll never be erased. They failed.
That's for sure. All right, we're going to have to leave it there. That's all the time we have for this program. Professor Jonathan Rosenhead and Katie Durbin, thank you both for sharing your thoughts with us. And thank you, Gaza Under Attack. We'll be back with the latest. Until then, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts. Goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. We'll be right back.
in the limelight.
Human rights groups are saying the United States is complicit in Israel's war crimes by aiding it militarily and providing it with intelligence to help Israel target Palestinians of the Gaza Strip. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Online American news organization The Intercept has covered this story and tells us more. A recent document has revealed that U.S. President Joe Biden's administration is quietly providing intelligence to the Israeli regime for targeting purposes in the war-torn Gaza Strip. Deploying U.S. Air Force intelligence engagement officers on the ground to the occupied Palestinian territories to help Israel conduct airstrikes and fired long-range artillery weapons at the population of Gaza. According to a deployment order obtained under the Freedom of Information Act and published by The Intercept, the Biden administration has been flying surveillance drone missions over Gaza since at least early November, ostensibly providing intelligence to the Israeli regime about captives being held in the Palestinian territory. At the time when the drone flights were revealed, U.S. General Pat Ryder claimed that the Special Operation Forces were not participating in target development. But several weeks later, on 21st of November, the U.S. Air Force issued deployment guidelines for officers, including intelligence engagement officers and airmen headed to the occupied Palestinian territories. The deployment guidelines were issued by the Pentagon's Air Force Component Command for West Asia, Air Forces Central. The document provides deployment instructions to air personnel sent to the occupied Palestinian territories, including an air defense liaison team, as well as airmen assigned to the intelligence engagement officer. The revelation comes at a time when the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, at The Hague, Netherlands, is opening hearings on a genocide case against the Israeli regime brought by South Africa. Experts say that a team of targeting officers like this will be used to provide satellite intelligence to Israeli officials for the purpose of offensive targeting. Lawrence Klein, who served as an intelligence engagement officer in Iraq before retirement, told The Intercept they're probably targeting people, targeting officers. Tyler McBrien, managing editor of Lawfare, a website specializing in national security law, said there seems to be an Israel exception to the U.S. rules around military assistance. Meanwhile, several progressive members of Congress have raised concerns that the United States' aid to Israel, both before and during the ongoing Gaza war, violates the so-called Leahy Law. The law, named after Senator Patrick Leahy, requires the U.S. government to vet foreign military units for gross violations of human rights when providing training or aid to those units. According to an investigation by the Israeli news website, Plus 972 magazine, the Israeli military intentionally strike Palestinian civilian infrastructure known as power targets in order to create a shock. Targets are generated using an artificial intelligence system known as Hapsora, the Hebrew word for gospel. The United States, Israel's biggest ally, has provided the regime with arms and ammunition since the war started on 7th of October. The U.S. House of Representatives on 2nd of November passed a standalone $14.3 billion military assistance package for Israel. However, the legislation is yet to clear the U.S. Senate. Amid simmering resentment across the region over America's support for Israel, which has massacred tens of thousands of innocent Palestinians, the Islamic Resistance in Iraq, an umbrella group of anti-terror organizations, has launched numerous missile and drone strikes against U.S. military installations in Iraq and in neighboring Syria. The New York Times has also covered the same story and tells us more. The New York Times report has quoted unnamed U.S. officials. The CIA has been providing intelligence to the Israeli regime on senior Hamas leaders and captives held in the Gaza Strip. According to the New York Times report, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan ordered the formation of a new task force to gather intelligence on the captives' whereabouts and Hamas leaders shortly after the 7th of October start to the war. It said Washington is spending many more resources on collective intelligence on Hamas than it was before the war, and is also carrying out more drone flights over Gaza to intercept communications between Hamas operatives. According to the report, the United States has already started transferring information to the Zionist regime on the location of senior Hamas leaders. However, it is not clear how effective this has been, and none of the major leaders in Gaza have yet to be assassinated or captured. The Israeli regime started its brutal military offensive against Gaza on 7th of October. The English website of Al Mayadeen television network has also covered the same story and tells us more. The American Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren says Washington needs to stop writing a blank check for Israel, since the Israeli regime continues to demonstrate an appalling disregard for Palestinian lives, particularly in the Gaza Strip. Senator Elizabeth Warren denounced recently the administration of Democratic President Joe Biden for unconditionally providing military aid to Israel. The Israeli military forces have massacred tens of thousands of innocent people, 70% of whom are women and children, since 7th of October. Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren wrote, "When it comes to military aid to Israel, the U.S. cannot write a blank check for a right-wing regime that's demonstrated an appalling disregard for Palestinian lives. The United States should use all the tools at its disposal to condition aid and move the parties towards a lasting peace." Senator Elizabeth Warren became one of the highest-profile Democrats to demand no further aid to the Israeli regime after Senator Bernie Sanders said the U.S. needs to stop being complicit in war crimes against Palestinians of the Gaza Strip. In a recent statement, Bernie Sanders said Israel's response to Operation Al-Aqsa Storm has been grossly disproportionate, immoral, and in violation of international law. He noted that Biden administration must no longer be complicit in destroying the lives of innocent Palestinian men, women, and children.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another episode of the program Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss different problems and issues parents might have concerning their children and teenagers. Well, in this program, our dear expert Sayyid Salman Naqavi is here with us, who is a faculty member of Al Mustafa International University. Assalamu alaikum, dear Sayyid.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you for accepting our invitation, brother.
Yes, it's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
The pleasure is all ours. Today, we are going to have a question and the way to communicate with our teenagers. Well, most parents have got a lot of difficulties to actually deal with their teenage children. The question is, how to effectively communicate with our teenagers? The stage is yours.
Thank you very much. It is a very important question, and many people have problems and difficulties in being able to communicate with their children, especially teenagers.
That's right.
Because though we should have been able to inculcate in them something, issues, some morals and values and behavioral traits when they were younger, especially in the early 3 years of development, early child development, it's very important to be able to imbibe our children and groom our children in a way that when they grow up and become teenagers, they're not so difficult to deal with.
That's right.
But unfortunately, many of us are not capable of doing that. We're not competent enough to mm-hmm. become parents.
You're right.
We think that parenting comes naturally, whereas we have to learn to become parents. We have to
require study.
Studies and learning, mostly it is learning, not necessarily by reading books, even having discussions with people who know uh-huh. psychologists and who educate educators, they educate parents, they tell us how to become a good parent.
And maybe well-experienced people.
Yes, experienced people, elderly people who have good experience. We need to begin to learn how to become good parents. And because becoming a parent is not just being a parent in the sense that we just need to take care of their physical needs and their uh-huh. clothing. And most of the time we're thinking that how are we going to feed our children? We are going to give them proper food and clothing and shelter. That becomes the major concern. And we're not very much engaged with the issue that we need to teach them good behavior also.
And it's a psychological issue, actually.
Yes. Generally speaking, anything which relates to their behavior, and we have been expounding on this in many of our previous discussions, that we need to become good educators to become good parents. And we also need to be able to understand what traits and behavioral things which are necessary for teenagers. I mean, we need to groom them to become competent people. We need to groom them to become, when they become of age, 15, 18, and cross their teenager age, they need to be good, responsible people of society. Mm-hmm. So we need to make them competent. I believe that being competent is the same as being a salih person. A person who is, as is mentioned in the Quran, that basically it is faith and good deeds and actions and behavior and conduct based on taqwa, which is going to lead you to salvation in this world and the hereafter. And we need to teach our children to become good people, good, competent human beings whose behavior is based and rooted in faith in Allah Almighty. Mm-hmm. So therefore, we need to be able to know what that it is, what the ideal behavior is, and then we need to be able to learn how to inculcate and imbibe that in our children. And the most important thing is to be able to communicate with them and to be able to tell them what we want them to become. But how to do that is important.
Okay, thank you, dear Sayyid. I think the better way to actually discuss the question is that how to have a competent teenager.
Exactly. A person who is competent and effective in society.
Mm-hmm. So, dear audience, let's take a break and we'll be back very soon. Stay with us.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear audience of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing, with me, Mahdi, and Sayed Salman Naqavi. Today we're talking about how we can have a competent and effective teenager in the society.
So
at your service, brother.
Yes, thank you. So basically the goal is to groom our children to become good people, efficient and effective. That's what being a muhsin, as is mentioned in the Quran, muhsineen, those who carry out good deeds and with excellence and competent, have taqwa, have faith in Allah Almighty. We're not talking about the general sense. Yes, good behavior, unfortunately, is thought to be something which is different from having faith in Allah. No, it's a result of having faith in Allah. So if we have faith in Allah, if we have taqwa, then we need to have good behavior, competent people. And for them to be able to learn how to become that, we need to communicate with them. Sometimes we see behavior which offends us, especially teenagers. Now, of course, we did say that early childhood development is important and that upbringing is very important. But still, when a person becomes a teenager, there are certain physical changes, hormonal changes, which are taking place in him or in her, which they cannot maybe understand what's happening. They're feeling changes in their physical bodies, in their hormones, in the way how they think and perceive the outside world. So these changes make them stressful. That makes them anxious. They're not allured and they're attracted by things which we do not think. For example, a girl would like to be makeup all the time. She has studies to take care of. She has to take care of other things, help her mother in chores maybe. And the mothers expect their children and their girls especially to help them in the household chores. And also learn how to become good wives maybe in the future. But a teenager girl or a boy has other interests. He is in a society, he's come into society, he has people, he has peers, she has peers, she wants to compete with them.
Maybe the way they look at the world is different.
Of course. I mean, they're experiencing new things, especially now that before that they did not have those hormonal changes in them. Now they're thinking of themselves, they think of their bodies, they think of how they look. And they want to attract others.
They want to stand out, actually.
Exactly. So now their behavior is much more tuned for this. And sometimes we're thinking something else. We think we don't comprehend maybe what they're thinking. They're thinking of something else, and we feel that they're, for example, ignoring us or they're disobeying us. No, they're in a different world altogether. They are thinking of other things. And we have been through those years and we have been through those stages ourselves, but we have forgotten what happened to us. So basically, we need to come back and understand, for example.
So they're not in the wrong way, actually.
No.
It's natural.
It is natural for them to be such. We have to realize that. So number one, if we want to be able to connect with them and communicate with them, we need to, let's give an example. A girl is putting on makeup on herself and she's wasting her time, in our opinion, in making up for herself because in the evening she's going to meet her friend and she wants to look good in front of her friends, for example. And we know, on the other hand, that this girl has to do her homework and to prepare herself for school tomorrow.
But this is our, actually, view.
Of course. So now there are two things we can do. We can either become furious and, you know, start
shout at them,
shout and yell at them and force them to do something that we want. Oh, go and study. Sit down. Don't waste your time. Don't waste your energy. Now we need to, instead of being furious, we need to show that we're curious. We need to make them understand that we realize, we understand what you're facing a situation.
I want to sit beside them, not in front of them. Dear Sayed, let's take a break and we'll be right back and then continue our discussion. The audience, stay with us.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
Imam Ali عليه السلام said, be like a friendly physician who applies medicine where it is useful.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
Welcome back, dear audience of IRIB English Radio. You're still listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. And Sayyid Salman Naghavi is talking about how we can communicate effectively with our teenager. At your service, brother.
I think 3 or 4 points have to be taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
When we face a situation where we feel that the teenager is not doing what he or she is supposed to do, not just because we think so, because actually it's for her or him, his benefit.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the girl is, as I said, was taking up time in making up, putting on makeup and lipstick or whatever. Maybe it's allowed to do so. Maybe she's going out with her friend and she wants to look good. It's not bad, but it's wasting her time because she needs to do something more important. Now you become curious and try to understand.
Mm-hmm.
What she's thinking, what she's feeling,
uh-huh.
and try to communicate to her that you understand what she wants, but maybe you want to make her realize yes, that's a good thing. It's not a bad thing. You empathize with her,
uh-huh.
but still you have something. Don't you have something more important to do? Are your studies okay? You don't need mm-hmm. help there. Maybe you don't need to work on your, for example, dissertation that the school has given or whatever. Make her emphasize on her that she needs to do something which is more important. And if she doesn't, she will see the consequences.
Mm-hmm.
She will face the problems. If, for example, if she does not do her homework, the day after, the school teacher will ask her to sit behind school time and, you know, complete her homework. So she will have to face the consequences.
Yes.
But if you become furious and you want and you lose your calm because you
uh-huh.
need to remain calm, she doesn't feel that, oh, if I'm not going to do this, then my mother is going to face the consequences.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not concerned. So I'm not. It's her problem, not mine.
Uh-huh.
So you need to make your teenager realize that she's going to be facing the problem. My mother is just empathizing with me and she wants to help me. She wants
uh-huh.
to assist me. She wants to be beside me to help me along mm. this path.
Uh-huh.
So you need to make them feel that the burden is upon her shoulder and she has to take it upon herself. And the mother or the father can only assist the child in getting over that problem.
Thank you, Sayyid Salman Naghavi. It was a very fruitful discussion. And dear audience, to have a competent teenager and have an effective interaction with him or her, as Sayyid Salman Naghavi said, we are supposed to sit by them, not in front of them. And look at the world through their view. And in order to correct their things that we think is problematic, we are supposed to show him or her the consequences of his job. And this way, we are going to be a person who is going to help them, not the one who is going to shout at them. The audience, if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. And you can follow us on Facebook and Instagram, typing Call of Islam Radio. Well, until another episode, have a nice time and goodbye.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Saint of the soil, from the blood and the ashes, it speaks with me the sound of the rain, from the battle and the victory.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.